We are at a major turning point this morning because as we move into the second half of the book of Isaiah, things change dramatically. For several hundred years, Assyria has been the most powerful and feared nation in the world. Israel had to make decisions about who they were going to trust, and that all revolved around Assyria in some way. All this took place within the lifetime of Isaiah. It was all directed mainly at the two kings who ruled during the majority of Isaiah's life, King Ahaz and his son, King Hezekiah. As we move into the second half of Isaiah, however, God gave some prophecies through Isaiah that will talk about events that happened over 100 years after the death of Isaiah. Assyria is coming to the end of its long period of terrorizing the nations. God gave her power to plunder the nations in order to teach them a lesson. But Assyria's purpose was to destroy, we saw back in chapter 10. And so God made it clear in Isaiah 33:1 that the destroyer would be destroyed. And so Assyria's time was coming to an end. So here is the situation that we're going to face at this point. Israel thought all along that the problem was Assyria. But Assyria never was the real problem. God could have saved them from Assyria at any time. He proved that when Sennacherib was sent home after 185,000 of his troops didn't wake up one morning. Israel's real problem was not Assyria all along. Her real problem was that she failed to trust in God. Now this was serious. God had made a promise to Abraham that through his seed all nations of the earth would be blessed. Now this was intended to happen in several ways. One of those was that the nations around would come to know God through the way that Israel lived. They would take a look at Israel, they would see the blessings that come from God, and they'd be drawn to God. God did not merely wait until the New Testament times for the nations to come to know Him. Israel was supposed to show the nations to God throughout all her history through how she lived. But now she is more corrupt than the nations around her. Instead of the nations following Israel to come to learn of God, Israel is following the nations into idolatry and corruption. And so here she is, more corrupt than the nations around her. We saw that in the first 5 chapters of Isaiah as it set the stage for all this. The rich people were perverting justice so that they could rob from the widows and the orphans. A national crisis hit, and Ahaz was terrorized, and he began running to Assyria for help instead of trusting for God. A national crisis hits later, and Shebna was so preoccupied with building himself a tomb to be memorialized throughout history that he was judged and lost his place. This line of history from Abraham was supposed to go up, but instead it went down. And as the line went down further and further, we began to wonder, is God going to keep His promise to the nations? How will He do that? It's on the heart of God that all people on the face of the earth come to know Him. How will He keep His promise to Abraham? How will He bring about that blessing through Abraham's descendants when they only get worse and worse and worse and don't seem to be doing anything at all to show God to the people? How can He do that when even one of the best kings, Hezekiah, can't really be what the people need? So here's a very serious issue. Judah is supposed to be servants of God. They're anything but that. So how is this line of history going to turn around? How is it ever going to produce what God intended? That's the story of the remainder of the book of Isaiah. It's also the story of the book of Ezekiel when you study that sometime. Now God knows that His people will not change merely because Assyria is destroyed. They're going to continue to trust other things. They will continue to run after idols. Hezekiah was a very good king, but we saw in chapters 38 and 39 that he's not the king that Judah really needed. And with one exception, the kings that come after him will be worse even than Ahaz was. Now, God would not let Assyria destroy Jerusalem. He promised that to King Hezekiah several times. Assyria wanted to depose Hezekiah and completely destroy Judah. They wanted to do with Judah what they'd done with the northern kingdom, spread the inhabitants out all over the earth, and it would cease completely to exist as a nation. Now, that flew in the face of what God intended to do with Judah. So he was not going to let Assyria destroy Jerusalem. They would not succeed. Assyria might destroy other nations in the Middle East, but they would never succeed with Judah. Therefore, God saw to it that the balance of power began to shift. For several hundred years, Assyria had been the most powerful and feared nation in the world. They terrorized all the other people. But in 612 BC, an amazing thing happened. Babylon destroyed the Assyrian capital of Nineveh. And later, 7 years later, in 605, Babylon would completely defeat Assyria, and a whole new era of world history was coming in. The superpower Assyria no longer exists, and as its place is a new world power, Babylon. Babylon becomes the one that Israel has to worry about. Although we hear about Judah going off into Babylonian captivity, there were really three different phases of that. In 605, Nebuchadnezzar carried some Jews away to captivity. Those captives included Daniel. They also included three Jews called Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Anyone know those by different names? Okay, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And then in 597 BC, the second deportation, another group of captives was carried away, and the prophet Ezekiel was part of that group of captives. And then finally, in 586 BC, as Judah continued to be a thorn in the side of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem. Zedekiah was the last king, and Jeremiah wrote about that event in the book of Lamentations. Judah continued to ignore God and go after idols. They continued to take advantage of the weak and the helpless. They continued to be worse than all the nations around them. They still weren't any credit at all to Abraham. Remember the song of the vineyard in chapter 5? God finally tore down his vineyard because he'd done every possible thing he could do, and it still only produced bad grapes. Finally, God would allow Babylon to come in and destroy Jerusalem and take them away into captivity. Suppose you were going to change things in Judah. All of Judah's existence from the time that they left Egypt, she's wavered as to whether to trust in God or not. God brought her out of Egypt, gave her a new nation, gave her a law so that she'd know how to live, gave her a great land, delivered her from oppression of other nations time after time. He sent prophets to call her back to the law when she abandoned it. Yet she would still not make up her mind to trust him. How can God change all that? Ultimately, God had to take away all the other things in which Judah trusted. The temple of God was in Jerusalem, and we read in the book of Jeremiah that instead of trusting God, they were trusting the fact that the temple was there in Jerusalem. And so Babylon tore down the temple. They trusted in as Jews, they were living in the land given to them. And so they were carried away into captivity in Babylon. They trusted in the fact that a son of David was on the throne. And so Babylon finally put governors in charge of the land, not someone of David's line. Do they understand what this is all about? To be sure they do. God sends Jeremiah to the people left behind in Jerusalem, and he sends Ezekiel to the people taken captive in Babylon. But even before that, he sends a message years earlier through Isaiah so that when they find themselves captives in Babylon and they begin to give up hope, they'll realize that there's still comfort to be had, that God still has a purpose for them, he still has a purpose for the world, and he intends to carry that out. But why Babylon? Well, Babylon was every bit as arrogant and prideful a nation as Assyria was. God would ultimately destroy Babylon for the same reasons that he destroyed Assyria. So why would he allow Babylon to destroy Jerusalem? I believe the answer is this. Assyria would have scattered the inhabitants around, a few here, a few there, mixed them up amongst the people, so that the kingdom of Judah, like the kingdom of Samaria, would never exist again. Babylon, however, had a different policy. They allowed the Jews to settle together in Babylon. The Jewish people were in captivity, and yet they remained a nation. And that meant that when God judged Babylon, he could raise up a ruler to take the Jews back home again. But they would come home very different people from how they left. Never in the history of the Jews were they primarily monotheistic until the Babylonian captivity. Never in the history of the Jews did they really realize the consequences of turning their back on God until the Babylonian captivity. Once they learned what they needed to know, God would take them back and restore them to their own land. Now, this is part of what the second half of Isaiah is about. We know from the book of Ezekiel that the captives got to Babylon with a false optimism. The first two times Nebuchadnezzar had come against Jerusalem, he'd taken away captives, but he hadn't destroyed the city. It still stood. Before long, these Jews who were captives in Babylon said, "Egypt's going to defeat Babylon. We're all going home. Don't unpack your bags. Don't settle in. We won't be here very long. Jerusalem's still standing. Nebuchadnezzar will fall. We'll go back to the land." Then, about midway through the book of Ezekiel, word came that the city was destroyed. All of a sudden, their false confidence was completely shattered. Their false optimism was gone, and in its place, there came to be a very deep pessimism. They were captives. The city was in ruins. The temple was torn down. Their entire world seemed hopeless. Now, if you were a Jew captive in Babylon at that time, what questions might come to your mind? Well, you might ask things like, "Has God forgotten us? Where is he?" That's exactly the question that they're asking. Isaiah transports himself 125 years or so into the future, as it were, and says, here's what Israel will be asking. Chapter 40 and verse 27. "Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, my cause is disregarded by my God?" See, that's what the Jews in Babylon were saying. Why is God not paying any attention to us? Has God forgotten us? We've been deserted. The temple is lying in ruins. The city of Jerusalem has been leveled. Where is God? That's the big question Isaiah has to answer. Amidst all, he has a message of comfort and hope to give to the people of Jerusalem. But sometimes those messages of hope are very difficult to deliver. Sometimes you do everything you can to be godly. Sometimes you try to do God's will, and then you get a brain tumor, as a 29-year-old friend of mine did some years ago. So how do you maintain your faith? But they have an even more difficult circumstance because they haven't been godly. They deserve to be in Babylon, and they knew it. It's hard enough to ask where God is when you've suffered so much after you've done your very best to live faithfully. But where are you going to get a message of hope when you've suffered so much and you finally realized that you not only deserve the suffering you endured, you actually deserved much worse than you got? Now, where does that message of hope come from? That's when Isaiah steps in with the last half of his book. Their enemies are scorning and ridiculing him. They taunt them. Turn over for a minute to Psalm 137. We're going to see an example of that. This is a psalm that was written in Babylon as the Jews were suffering. And they said, "By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion." This whole thing was affecting them emotionally. "There on the poplars we hung our harps." For there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded of us songs of joy. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? You can see the despair, the pessimism, the sorrow just coming out, the kind of emotional feelings that come up inside a person who is being ridiculed for their life and for their faith. Look at the question in verse 4. He's really asking, how can I maintain any joy, any confidence, any hope when my world has been torn apart? We also might ask, how do you keep bitterness and resentment toward your enemies from controlling your life? Those kind of questions are what Isaiah is going to answer. He's going to tell them about the reality of God. When their situation seems hopeless, he's going to talk about deliverance. See, look what he says about Cyrus in chapter 44, verse 28, who says of Cyrus, he's my shepherd and will accomplish all that I please. He will say of Jerusalem, let it be rebuilt. And of the temple, let its foundations be laid. Now think how incredible this is. At the time Isaiah wrote, Babylon was not a world power. Assyria still dominated Babylon and all the other nations and would for many, many more years. Who knew at that time that Babylon would destroy Assyria and that the Medes and Persians would eventually take over Babylon? Who knew at that time that there would even be a ruler named Cyrus, not yet born? Much less that this ruler named Cyrus, not yet born from a power that the world did not yet recognize, would be responsible for getting the temple in Jerusalem rebuilt. Cyrus wouldn't even be born for over 150 years. This is a very specific prediction. Now, it's one thing to make a prediction. It's another thing if it happens just the way you said. Did this prediction happen? Well, turn over to the book of Ezra, chapter 1. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. So the first thing Isaiah does in this last half of the book of Isaiah is give them hope. But as we've seen before, the best kings, David, Hezekiah, Josiah, those kings weren't able to be the kind of kings that Judah truly needed. If Israel was going to be a servant of God, they needed a king who could truly show them what it meant to be a servant of God. But where would that king come from? What was he like? What kind of king would he be? Well, the immediate context of Isaiah 40 through 66 is the Babylonian captivity, the reasons for it, the restoration from it. But a greater deliverance than that is needed to redeem and restore all the nations the way God promised that he would to Abraham. And so God is going to call Cyrus as the first step to that. He's going, in fact, in the book of Isaiah to call Cyrus a Messiah. And yet a greater Messiah, a greater anointed one than Cyrus is going to be needed to redeem all the nations of the world. We're going to see the country of Judah called Jacob many times throughout the last half of Isaiah. We're going to see them as the servant, but they won't live up to what the servant should be. But finally, we'll see one man, one servant, one righteous man, who will live up to what that servant should be. He will be the kind of king that Judah needs. He'll be the kind of king whose followers will have a vision to take the knowledge of God to every nation under heaven, and they won't rest until they do. He'll be a shepherd to the nations. He'll call all people to him. It's no accident that the New Testament uses so much language from the second half of Isaiah. This section of Isaiah shows us how God took this downward trend of history, this trend that seemed to be headed for complete extinction in Babylon, and turned it around to bring into the world the kind of king that Israel needed, and the kind of king that every nation in the world needed if they were going to come know who God is. That's what the second half of Isaiah is all about. Get excited when you read it. Let it penetrate you. Let it impress you with the wonder of God. Let it call you to obedience for God and love for God. Let it fill you with comfort the way God intends for it to do. Let it build up your faith in God. Let it cause you to put your trust in Him in a way that you never have before. And let it enlarge your vision for God. Let it get us away from our short-sightedness and cause us to realize that God went to the extent He did so that all nations would come to know Him, and that as disciples of the King that He sent, we ought to have a burning passion for the world to come to know God. We ought to care deeply about that. Let it cause us to care more than about our church or our neighborhood, but let it cause us to care about the people around us and the country we live in and our hemisphere and our planet that are all still, as Jesus said, under the control of the evil one. So let it penetrate us. Let this second half of Isaiah get inside us, and it's going to build our faith in a powerful way. It's going to increase our vision in some ways that we may not have thought possible, and it's going to bring us joy and comfort in some ways that we may have never imagined. That's what the second half of Isaiah is all about. Now in chapters 40 through 48, which is the part that we're getting into, four points are emphasized. First of all, God wants to deliver them. That's good news, because they are about as down as they can possibly get. God can deliver them. That's good news because Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon seem to hold all the cards. Idols cannot deliver them. And Israel remains chosen and precious in the sight of God despite all that's happened. God will deliver Israel. He'll use them. They'll be His servants. Even after they were carried away captive to Babylon, even after the city has been destroyed, even after the temple has been leveled, God still intends to redeem them and restore them. And so the first question that we find in chapter 40, the first 11 verses, is, does God want to deliver us? See, with what word does this section of Isaiah begin? It starts out in verse 1, comfort. Comfort my people, says your God. Comfort. Remember, these are the same people God took to court in chapter 1. They're the same people He called a worthless vineyard in chapter 5. Actually, they're not the same people, because we've jumped ahead 150 years or so, and they're people who have not learned the lesson from the events of Isaiah's day, and so they've become even more corrupt than the worthless vineyard was in chapter 5, and that's why they're in Babylon in the first place. And to these people, He turns around and says, comfort? What is that all about? Here you are in Babylon. You were taken against your will. You've lost your home. Family members have died in the fighting. You've lost everything you hold dear, but at least you were optimistic. Egypt was going to defeat Babylon and we'd be going home again soon. Then the news comes that Jerusalem is destroyed. You won't be going home. You're here for a long, long time. You're homesick. You're discouraged. You're struggling to survive in a foreign nation. And in the midst of that, someone hauls out a copy of the writings of Isaiah and reads these words, comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Well, I could use comfort. God seems to be saying to the prophets, you preached judgment when it was time for that, when they needed that, but now that's over. It's a time for comfort. How do you comfort someone that is going through one of the most difficult crises they've ever faced? Well, he goes on to say, you speak to them tenderly. There's a time for speaking harshly and being direct and to the point, but there's also a time for speaking tenderly. God had the prophet speak to them forcefully to get their attention, to try to keep them from winding up in Babylon in the first place. But they didn't listen, and now here they are. But now's the time to speak to them tenderly. Now's the time to change your tone. It's time to give them hope. Tell Jerusalem, he says, that her hard service has been completed. Tell her this won't last forever. She's paying the consequences for her sins, but that's almost done. That's almost over. It's about time to get back home, and there's hope, and they won't be captives in Babylon forever. God gives comfort and hope to the exiles, but this section also gives hope and comfort to those who are suffering the consequences of sin and need relief. We'll find some things in that that will bring us great joy and hope as well, as we see God's faithfulness worked out across generation after generation and century after century. We'll see that God will provide the kind of king that people need. The deliverance from Babylon is going to be great, but the deliverance under the Messiah, that's something that's almost unimaginable. And so, comfort my people. Three things he says: that her service has been completed, that her iniquity has been atoned for, and that her sins, they've been paid for abundantly. Double, he says. And then he talks about the voice of one calling in the desert, prepare the way of the Lord. By this time, they've realized that they're in Babylon because of their unfaithfulness. But at the same time, what can you say about God? The Babylonians claim that their God, Bel and Marduk and the others, are great because they've toppled all the nations. They've given them victory over every nation. They're the conquerors. They're on top. What great gods we must have in Babylon and Bel and Marduk to make us such a powerful nation. Well, if you're Israel, you think, what about us? Well, all the nations say our God must not be very powerful. He didn't protect us. He let Babylon overrun us. He let his own house, the temple in Jerusalem, be torn down by invading armies. He let his own people be taken as prisoners to a faraway land. What can we say about this God? Can he help us? Does he want to help us? And suddenly you hear this voice ring out, prepare a highway for God. In ancient times, when a king traveled, they took special care to make his way smooth. In English today, we'd say they rolled out the red carpet for him. In ancient times, it was more than that. They might fill in a swamp or move a boulder or cut down an obstacle because they wanted the way smooth for the king. But he's not simply telling them a king's coming. He says, prepare the way for God himself. God doesn't need anyone to physically fill in valleys or cut down mountains. That's not his whole point. He's telling them after their discouragement, after their despair, they need to get ready because the king over all the universe hasn't forgotten them. He's coming again. See, in the book of Ezekiel, we see the glory of God early in the book leaving the city of Jerusalem because it's become so corrupt. But later in Ezekiel, we'll see God returning back to that city. That's what Isaiah is talking about. But now, prophets, you have good news for the city. God intends to return to this rubble of a city. He's coming. And that's what this picture of a highway tells us. That's good news. God is coming back, so make a highway ready for him. Get ready. Yes, we've become so corrupt that God allowed us to go into Babylon for 70 years. Could we ever hope that God would show his face to us again? Could we ever hope that God might show his power at work among us again the way he's done in the past? And then suddenly this voice rings out, yes, you can. Get the road ready because God is coming. His glory was revealed once in the wilderness when he took them out of Egyptian captivity, made them into a nation, and gave them a land. And when he talks about his glory being revealed, when he talks about a highway in the wilderness, you can latch on to that because you can look back in your history and see when that happened before. It's happened once, so it can happen again. He could lead them out of Egypt and reveal his glory, so surely he can lead them out of Babylon and reveal his glory. And finally, the nations will see who he truly is. Because in both cases, Egypt and Babylon, the purpose behind it was so that all the nations would come to know God for who he is. But what was one of the biggest obstacles to the Exodus from Egypt? The biggest obstacle was really not Pharaoh. The biggest obstacle was that when the people faced difficulty in the wilderness, the first thing they began to think of was, you know, it was pretty good back in Egypt. And that captivity, that slavery, all of a sudden didn't seem so bad. Let's go back and be slaves again. The biggest obstacle to the Exodus from Babylon was very similar. They'd settled down and built houses and started businesses. So it was not very attractive to many of them to go back to a city that was a pile of rubble and start to rebuild it. Remember also that this captivity had lasted 70 years, so there were very few still in Babylon who had even seen Jerusalem, much less remembered much about it. On the other hand, the people in Jerusalem who were left there were pretty weary. Rebuild this mess? We're too far gone. We lack the strength. That's why he's going to tell them later in the chapter, God's the one who strengthens the weary. Now we'll see in the New Testament that when God came to earth, he sent another prophet with this same message. They asked John the Baptizer who he was. He quoted Isaiah, and he said, I'm the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way for God. See, last time God sent a voice crying in the wilderness, it was good news. God was showing himself to the people. He was bringing deliverance. No wonder God would have John say, God is ready to show himself again. And so he's sending the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Look at the good news. A voice suddenly comes then and says, cry out. And he says, what shall I cry? Cry out that all men are like grass. He cry out that their glory is like the fading flowers of the field. See, the voice answers, cry out to understand the difference between what men say and what God says. Well, what do you mean, Isaiah? Why is that important? Throughout the first part of this chapter, God is telling someone to speak. Verse 2, to call out. Verse 6, or in verse 9, to get up on a mountain and say to the cities of Judah, here's your God. We're going to see good news, but what's the good news? Well, in verse 2, the good news is she's suffered enough. In verses 3 through 5, the good news is the glory of the Lord is going to be revealed. In verses 6 through 8, the word of the Lord can be trusted. Will there be opposition to what God says from other nations and people? Well, yes, of course there will. But who is that opposition? Well, it's people like the king of Babylon who hold you captive and won't let you return home. You think because of the glory and power that surrounds them, there's no hope for you to get away from Babylon and get home. But the opposition is only flesh. It's not God. Babylon is like the grass or flower in the field. It looks good on the surface. But what happens to grass and flowers eventually? They fade and their glory withers. They don't last. People across the earth once bowed to the kings of Babylon and their seemingly limitless power. In the last 100 years or so, when have you heard of anybody bowing to a king of Babylon? Or in the last 1,000 years or so? See, their glory has faded, and today Babylon lies desolate. But then what can we trust? What can we rely on? The word of the Lord. It stands forever. It will be there. You may think that there's no hope because the power and the glory of the king of Babylon is holding you captive, but God has said, comfort. Comfort my people. Prepare the highway. God is coming. All the glory of Egypt, Assyria, and Babylon will all fade and dry up like a flower, but what God says never will. You can depend on it. And then in verse 9, there's good news being proclaimed to the captives in Babylon. It's too good to merely say in a normal voice, so go up on the mountaintop and shout it. Lift it up, make sure they hear. But hear what? Shout what? Shout, here is your God! See, don't just say, here's your God. Here is your God! That's important. That's good news. And it needs to be proclaimed at the top of your voice. Make sure they hear. You thought he'd completely turned his back on you. You didn't even know if he wanted to deliver you. You weren't even sure he could deliver you. You weren't sure but what he had abandoned you completely. It seems as if you'd languished in captivity and sorrow so far away from home. But the good news is, here's your God. He comes with power. But do we want him to come with power? See, last time he came with power, it was with the armies of Babylon to tear down the walls of Jerusalem because it was the only way left for him to try to reach through to the people. But he says, don't worry. This time he's coming like a shepherd. He's coming like a shepherd tending his flock. This time he's coming to take his lambs, holding them close to his heart. His purpose never was to destroy you. It was always to save you. It was to bring you back to him so that he could hold you close to him as he always wanted to do when you kept rejecting him. And so behold him. He comes and he comes with might. Don't worry about the power of Babylon that oppresses you. He can take care of that. He comes like a shepherd to guide you out of the wilderness into good ground. That's how he was in the Exodus. David said that in Psalm 78:51. He brought his people out like a flock. And so he delivers. He leads like a shepherd. No wonder he says, get up on the mountaintop and shout, behold God. Who wouldn't want to see a God like that? He'll tend his flock. He'll take his little lambs that can barely stand. He'll gently lead the nursing ewes. Isn't it a wonderful God to have that his purpose is to take care of his people like a shepherd? Now those people who are leaders in the church need to pay special attention to that. Because we need to help people understand and see the nature of God. That he's the kind of God who wants to care for his people and lead them gently like a shepherd. As leaders in the kingdom of God, people need to have that same kind of attitude. It means as we train new leaders, we need to train them to lead that very way. But languishing in Babylon without hope, the first question Israel had was, God, does God even want to deliver us? Hasn't he completely given up on us? The voice shouting from the top of the mountain says, God has not given up on you. Yes, he wants to deliver you. Yes, Babylon holds you captive. But Babylon consists only of men, and the glory of men withers and fades. God's word stands forever, and you can count on it. Well, then the next question they ask is, can God deliver us? So beginning in verse 12, they think, well, it may be a relief that God wants to deliver us, but look at how powerful Babylon is. How can we ever get back home? How powerful is God? If I'm going to put my trust in him, don't I want to know how powerful he is? Can he even do what he says? Isaiah says to us, I'm glad you asked that question. Let me give you a few illustrations. You think Babylon is powerful? You think Nebuchadnezzar is powerful? You think idols or evil spirits have any power? Well, listen to this. Suppose you went to the very deepest part of the ocean. Tell me, how would you measure the depth? The deepest part of the ocean, the Marianas Trench, I understand, is 11 kilometers deep. I've never taken my yardstick out and tried to measure that myself. I'll just rely on the people who tell me that. But see, how did they figure that out? Did someone climb out of a boat with a one-foot ruler and go down in the ocean? Well, not at all. The weight of the water would crush a man. It took thousands of years for people to even learn how to build an instrument that could measure something like that. What about the heavens? How far is the Andromeda galaxy from Earth? 2.6 million light years, I understand. Now, how do you measure that? You put one hand up here and say, okay, here's the Andromeda galaxy. Okay, here's the Earth over here. Oh, I'd say roughly 2.6 million light years, I'd say. Anybody want to try to measure that way? How does God measure the depth of the ocean or the distance between galaxies? Isaiah says he does it with his hand. He can just kind of say, okay, here's the Andromeda galaxy, here's Earth, 2 million light years, not a problem. And you're worried about the power of Babylon when God can do something like that? How does God weigh the mountains? You ever try to weigh a mountain? Be kind of difficult. But Isaiah says God can weigh the mountains as on scales. Anyone in here want to try that? God can pile up all the sand on the earth and weigh it. Anybody want to try that? So let's put Babylon and Assyria on one side over here, and let's put the God that Isaiah just showed us on the other side. Who do you really want to trust? Now, can God do what he says? Well, let's look at verses 13 and 14. Let's talk about wisdom for a minute. Who did God consult before he created the universe? What architect did God see to draw up the plans for putting all the planets and galaxies and stars in place in the first place? What teacher did God have to go study with in order to get understanding? Who taught God so that he'd know what he knows? Even asking that question makes us realize how powerful God is. You can't say that about Nebuchadnezzar. You can't say that about any other Babylonian king. All those kings have to have teachers and surround themselves with advisors, but God doesn't need any advisor. Well, that's convincing, but do you realize how powerful a nation like Babylon is? No nation on earth can defeat her. She's the ruler of the world. How can God say, we'll have hope, we'll go home, when the greatest nation the earth has ever seen is holding us captive right here in Babylon? Well, in verse 15, Isaiah says, surely the nations are like a drop in the bucket, or like dust on the scales. See, I had to explain to my Cambodian students our English phrase, drop in the bucket, but they understood very easily because they all carried water in the bucket. A drop in the bucket is insignificant. You know, you don't haul the bucket away and you spill a drop out and you say, oh, I lost a drop of water. I better go back and look for it and find it. I don't want to lose that drop of water. It's insignificant. You don't even notice it's gone. And if you do see it spill out, you don't really care. God says, that's how significant the nations are when you compare them to God. All nations are like a speck of dust on the scale. Now, some of you go into the bathroom and step on the scales once in a while. How many of you stop and sweep the dust off the scales before you step on it just to make sure that measurement is absolutely accurate? Okay, well, I won't ask you to show your hands. I know there's probably one or two who are trying to get that weight down who might do that. But seriously, how many of us sweep the dust off the scales? It's insignificant. A speck of dust on the scale is not going to even measure on it at all. If you weighed anything before you stepped on the scale and weighed it afterwards, no difference. Well, this Babylon that has you so discouraged, you know what God said it really is? It's a speck of dust on the scale. You've got God over here and Babylon over here. Babylon looks to be powerful. But God could stretch out his hand and say, well, Earth to Andromeda galaxy, all about here to here, about 2.6 million light years, and he could do that. What can Babylon do? They can be a speck of dust on a scale that's so insignificant in the big scheme of things, you don't notice them. You see how magnificent God is? Suppose you wanted to make a burnt offering worthy of God. Isaiah says, good luck with that. Lebanon was known for its magnificent trees and vast forests, and yet Isaiah says there are not enough trees in a country of heavy forests like Lebanon to build a decent fire for a burnt offering to God. And if you gathered up all the animals in the entire country, there aren't enough animals there to make a suitable burnt offering to God. Do you really think Babylon can keep you going from going home when God says you're going home? And then he says, are you still not sure you can trust what God says? All right, to whom will you compare God? How could you make an image that would even begin to reflect what God was like? Well, you might start with gold or silver, but are gold and silver really precious enough to represent God? If you don't have enough money for gold and silver, you might try to carve an image out of wood. Isaiah says, well, you better select a tree that won't ever rot, but good luck with that. And even if you could, you wouldn't want your image to fall over, so you'd have to have a very skilled craftsman to make it. But how can it honor God when you even have to worry about whether it's going to fall over or not? Do you begin to see that you can't make a comparison between the idols of the nations and God? Comparing the idols of the nations to God is not like comparing apples and oranges. It's like trying to compare the entire universe maybe to a piece of hair falling off a dog or something. There's just no comparison whatever. They are so unlike, where do you even begin? To whom do you really compare God? Now he's going to lecture Israel. You're sitting there in hopelessness. You think you're in Babylon. Jerusalem is destroyed. Your God has abandoned you. All hope is gone. You're not even sure he can get you out of Babylon. But don't you know? Haven't you heard? Haven't you understood this from the foundation of the world? God is the one who sets above the circle of the earth. See, in relation to him, the inhabitants of the world are like grasshoppers. God stretches out the heavens like a tent to dwell in. Now, all these kings of Babylon who have so much power, what does God do to them? He reduces them to nothing. He simply blows them away like tumbleweeds out on the desert. Do you think any king of Babylon can thwart God? Who's the equal of God? Look up and see the stars. You can't count them, and yet God calls them by name. Now, suppose I called you over to my house tonight, and we went out and looked up at the stars, and we looked up here, and I said, now look, right over here, if you look a little bit to the right and down just a little bit, there's a star missing up there. What are you going to say to me? The kindest thing you probably do is laugh at me. A star missing? How do you know there's a star missing up there? You can't even count the stars. How would you know if one is missing? Well, I can't. God can't. See, now, what was that again about you thinking Babylon could stand in the way of God taking you back home when he'd said he would do that? And so he's given us a comparison here. The idols are created by craftsmen. A poor man may use wood, but you have to pick out wood that won't rot. You have to be careful that it won't topple over. What kind of power does that have? God sits enthroned above the earth with people like grasshoppers, stretches out his heavens like a tent, reduces the rulers of the earth to nothing, created the heavens, calls each star by name, makes sure no star was missing. Who are you really going to trust in? And then their third question, can we be delivered? All right, God wants to give us comfort and hope and restore us. God has the power to bring us home, but there's one thing missing. We're tired. We're weary. Even if he wants to bring us home, we're not sure we've got the strength to go. Have you ever felt that way? You'd think they'd hear this message of comfort and the exiles would be ready to go. You'd think this message of comfort would come and the people still left in Jerusalem, their hearts would burn with passion, their spirits would get on fire, they'd be ready to rebuild. That's wonderful news, isn't it? Well, maybe not completely. Here you are in exile. You've merged yourself into the daily grind of life. You've worked hard to build a business and keep it going. But finally you did. You have a job here. You have friends. You have to ask yourself, do I really have the energy to leave all this and go back to Jerusalem and start over? Do I have enough strength left at the end of the day to say, yes, I'm ready to give up everything I've built here and go to a place that's ruins and rebuild it? Do I share God's vision for going back and rebuilding Jerusalem? I've got no time or energy for dreams. The situation in Jerusalem is not much different. They're thinking, I've had to make it for years in a country where there's no leadership because it's all been carried away to Babylon. It's been a grind just to get up and go about my business every day. The temple's in ruins. There are no priests here to offer sacrifice to God. The walls of the city are piles of rubble that I have to walk around every day just to get to the marketplace or to go out of the city to my fields. There's been so much devastation, so much discouragement. Do I have any strength left to rebuild? When I come home at the end of the day, do I even want to think about rebuilding? This rubble has been in the city for decades now. I've learned just how to live and not set my hopes too high. Rebuilding, well, that has to be a pipe dream. In Babylon, they're trying to treat their weariness with idols or recreation or money. It's all not so different from the kind of weariness that people face today. Some did go back, of course, but read how easily they got discouraged and how much Zerubbabel and Nehemiah and Zechariah had to encourage them to the rebuilding of the walls and the rebuilding of the temple. And they finally got into the rebuilding of the walls, but it wasn't easy to get started. And that didn't even carry over to the temple at first. There were many years of discouragement to come. But Isaiah responds to their thinking. He says, "Why would you think that God just got tired and overlooked your need? Don't you know? Haven't you heard? He's the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth. Do you think that God is too tired and too overworked to help you? God doesn't have to sit down at the end of the day and say, 'Oh, my back is killing me because I've worked so hard.' He doesn't have to come home at the end of the day and say, 'Man, I'm so tired, I just want to plop down in a chair and rest.' But what does God do? He gives strength to the weary. He gives power to the powerless. You're youths, yet if you work all day, don't you get tired? So to whom does new strength come? It will come to those who wait on the Lord." Ahaz didn't wait on the Lord. He sent emissaries to Egypt. Hezekiah at first didn't wait on the Lord. He revolted against Assyria and sent emissaries to Egypt. But strength comes to those who wait on the Lord. Well, what does that word wait mean? Well, if we look at other passages where that same word is used in Hebrew, we see that it means to have a confident expectation. It means to turn to God and have a confidence and an expectation that God will do what He's promised He will do. Those who wait on God will stretch out their wings like eagles. They'll lift up their wings to soar into the sky. And whether you run or whether you walk, God will supply the strength to take care of the comfort and the hope that He's promised. They will walk and not faint. The most likely place to faint, to grow weary, is here in this steady plodding of every day. The normal response is to help people rely on their own strength and their own resources. But as difficulties begin to pile up, that only leads to collapse. If we're going to soar again, we have to receive and to come to know God. And so the word renew means to exchange. We're exchanging what we are for what He is. We're exchanging our weariness for His strength, our exhaustion for His power. But that's not automatic. It comes to those who wait on the Lord. Those who wait upon the Lord shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not grow weary. They shall walk and not faint. You know, sometimes it feels good to mount up on those wings like eagles and soar. Sometimes we've had times in our lives where we can do that. And doesn't that make you feel wonderful? And you realize that strength, that blessing comes from God. But that's not always the way God deals with us. Sometimes we're just running, going as hard as we can, and God says, "I'll give you the strength to keep going." And sometimes when we face those deep crises in our lives, when we're dealing with what just seems to overwhelm us, with something that makes it hard just to even get up the next morning, God gives us the strength to walk. We don't have the strength to run. We're not soaring like eagles. But God says, "Go ahead and put one foot in front of the other. Go ahead and keep going. Trust in me." And sometimes the greatest blessing God even gives is just the ability to walk and not faint, just to keep going. Well, he gave his people a message of hope. And so that's how he starts out this section talking about Babylon. But he's going beyond this because he's not in the second half of Isaiah just giving his people hope. He's going to bring hope to the entire world. You see, his people are only part of the equation. They're part of the promise God made Abraham that he didn't bless the Jews so the Jews could be blessed people. He blessed the Jews so the world could be a blessed world. And so he's going to tell us, looking even farther ahead than Babylon, looking even farther ahead than the hopelessness and discouragement that they face, he's going to look ahead and say, how can I cure the hopelessness and discouragement of every nation, of every people? Now, there's a message in there for us. I didn't have this in my notes, but I want to share it because I think it's really important. See, God blessed the Jews because he wanted them to take that blessing, that message of comfort, that message of hope, so that everybody else could have that. You and I are recipients today of that. Jesus didn't grow up in Missouri. He didn't even grow up in the U.S. We're blessed by what has been done somewhere else, far away. A couple of years ago, I met with some church leaders from a congregation in Singapore. They were in Cambodia, and they were there because they wanted to help out some young preachers to take the message of Jesus to people in Singapore. And what they said touched me very deeply. One of them, very well-to-do, very talented businessman, but he said, years ago, somebody brought the message of Jesus to our shores. We were a poor country. We didn't have many resources. But somebody cared enough about us to bring that message. He said, now we're a rich country. We've got resources. Our vision is to care enough about somebody else to take that message. Now, as we read through the second half of Isaiah, we're going to see that the heart of God is to have a message for the entire world. Do you have a message for the people next door? Do you have a message for the people at school? Do you have a message for Baldwin and Ellisville? Or a message for Missouri? Or a message for South Africa? A message for Romania? A message for Cambodia? See, God has a vision. We're blessed because we received from somebody else. And as disciples of God, we want to have that same vision that he had. And that's what Isaiah is going to call us to as we go through, is the wonderful power, the magnificence of God and all that he's done. And he's going to try to create in us hearts of trust, hearts of hope, hearts of comfort, and hearts of vision. I hope you find the second half of Isaiah as exciting as I do. And I hope you'll pray that God will give me the words to present it in the way that it deserves to be presented, because it's no ordinary message and certainly no ordinary book. For next week, read again chapter 40 and then read chapters 41 through 45, and we'll see you next week.